You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers with Fran Barber and Robin Whittaker.
Greetings, folks. It's the ninth week after Pentecost, or proper 12, and Robin and I will be talking about 2 Samuel 11, 1 to 15, a brief foray, I think, into Ephesians 3, 14 to 21, and John 6, 1 to 21. And just a note that if you're in the car with children or you're a survivor, that we will be talking about the story of David and Bathsheba in fairly direct terms.
Thanks, Fran. Let's get into that 2 Samuel 11 reading, which might be known to many of you as the rape of Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah. We're going to explore this a little bit, but I want to start by naming that the history of scholarship on this, is a good example of the amount of bias we all bring to a biblical text. I was rather horrified to find commentaries and things that are not really that old that will still frame Bathsheba as the seductress, that will talk about this as adultery, which, of course, in our contemporary terms, at least, it's not. It's rape. It's a
It is technically adultery, but it's a way more than that.
It's also something else. Also, but really, there is a long tradition of blaming the victim, of Bathsheba being the one who's blamed for being deliberately provocative, as one scholar put it, by displaying her beauty, apparently, which I think is just a misreading of the story, but is also, of course, takes us right into some of the dynamics of powerful men abusing their power, and how when they're generally lauded for being great at other things, and David is remembered as being a great leader, we just can't quite believe, and in this case it's mostly male scholars, who just can't quite believe that he's also a rapist and a murderer.
Which it's interesting, just at this general point, that some scholars do seem to find that hard to believe. When you only have to read the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew 1, for example, to see a whole lot of names that involve all sorts of heinous things, somehow God's history absorbs this stuff and redeems humanity remarkably through this sort of history.
Can I do a few little exegetical points?
Yes, I've got one myself, okay, but you may do it anyway, so let's see. Let's see whether you cover it.
Just to note, in the first verse, I mean, there's a framing that already raises questions about David's character. It's spring. It's the time, we're told, when kings go out to battle, but David is at home, being a man at leisure.
On his couch,
on the roof. We're told David remained in Jerusalem. So already there's a question mark about what David's doing there. So we need to notice that framing. We also need to notice too, and Fran and I were debating about art, because I feel like I was always told that Bathsheba was somehow bathing on a rooftop and therefore putting herself on display. But David is the one on the roof. He's walking on the roof, he's reclining on the roof, and so I think the direction of gaze is he's looking down from a point of height, possibly into her room, into her courtyard in the neighbouring house, and sees her. So again, the narrative, the fact he's on the roof, that it might be practical, but it also gives us he's at an elevated height. Mm. It says something about their perspectives.
I just want to say too, it happened. I was struck by those two words at the start of verse 2. Yes. Something loaded about that, about the narrator knowing.
And it happened.
That it happened. Something really significant / bad happened.
Yes.
I don't know how else they might have put it.
No, but, and it's one of those little vayahi, which is just one of these and it happened that day, and then we're going to get this terrible thing happening. But
It's quite a sparing use of language and words here, isn't it?
It is, and the verbs say in verse 4 move very quickly with he sent messages to, and they took her and she came and he lay with her. This is very sort of expedient.
There's no, David thought to himself, will I or won't I, or I probably shouldn't, or, she's so beautiful, I can't even control myself. There's no even.
We don't get
even,
any musing.
Obscure, questionable rationalising going on.
Yep. And I think the other thing just before that, which I skipped over in verse 3, is, David notices her as a beautiful woman. we need to say, back in, I think it's chapter 3 of 2 Samuel, we've had a long list of David's wives and other children. There's at least six named wives. It's not like he does not have an array of women available to him. Not that that would excuse it, but, you know, it's part of the picture here. But he sees something beautiful and he wants it. And he inquires, and the naming of her as Bathsheba, A, she's named, which is significant, and we'll get to her tradition after this. But she's the wife of Uriah, so she's someone else's wife. So in a patriarchal society, he's actually about to commit a sin against the husband by taking his wife. And Uriah's a Hittite, which and Bathsheba's the daughter of Eliam. So she's a foreign woman to a foreign husband, but part of one of David's commanders. So there's a sort of a doubling down. He knows who she is, but he still takes her.
Yeah. Something I read too drew attention to the fact that the Hebrew word for get, so he went to take her, it's the word get, the same word that is used in Samuel when the Israelites are warned against having a king because kings will take your daughters. Yes. And so there's a recollection there, a subtle one, but for those who can note the language.
Yeah.
There's a reminder there that he is behaving as a king and indeed as a rapist, perhaps.
Yes, yes. That the taking of daughters or whatever you want is actually ancient kingly power. There's a whole lot of stuff about the washing we might return to, but just to note that I really don't like the NRSV translation that she was purifying herself after her period. There's an article I'll link to in the show notes that shows very clearly that the language here of washing is about purifying, probably after a sex act. There's no hint of menstruation here, but that this, I think that translation is probably again because of the later story that she's pregnant with David's child, who will die, but is about lineage. It's about making it really clear that it couldn't be Uriah's, but that's actually not there in the Hebrew or, in fact, in the Septuagint Greek. Mm-hmm. So bit of a weird translation, and it's probably helpful if we just leave menstruation out of it because that's a bit of a side effect or, yeah, red herring. I think those were most of my – there's probably much else we could say, but let's go to bigger picture, Fran. What would you preach this text?
Well, as it happens, I am preaching this on this Sunday. And in my thinking, I've been influenced by a phrase that actually Craig Thompson, one of our colleagues, used about – well, it's about David telling his own story. What is it that David tells himself about himself that means he goes and heads – goes ahead and does this sort of at the level of we all rationalize our behavior. We don't need to go actually to such extreme scenarios in our tradition to see that happening, and we all do it in our own lives. And this comment I'm about to make will then extend into the Samuel reading for next week, but I'm going to find it useful to actually bring 1 Samuel 12, where the prophet Nathan speaks to David. I'd like to bring that into the conversation at this point. So the prophet Nathan sort of tricks David after this episode and tells him a parable about a rich man with heaps of livestock and a poor man with one lamb ewe who's been lovingly reared by the poor man's family. Along comes a traveller, presumably hungry, says to the rich man, could I have one of your livestock? And the rich man won't let him and says, oh, but you can have this ewe over here belonging to this guy. And in the process, I mean, what Craig says is that Nathan restories David. David forgets that what he's done, and he's listening to this, and his reaction is, that man deserves to die, that rich man, that is wrong. And Nathan says, you are that man. So there's something about what's going on there that I find quite interesting. And I'm also struck, we're not going to talk in great depth today about the psalm, but Psalm 14 set for this day begins, fools say in their hearts there is no God, they are corrupt, they do abominable deeds, and there is no one who does good. David is actually acting, or in the episode before us in chapter 11, as if there is no God. God is completely in the background and not mentioned until this conversation, this parable with Nathan, when after David's condemned the rich man, we find that the Lord appears in the narrative and condemns David indeed.
Yes.
And So, yeah, I'm interested in that sort of line and how we resolve that. Is it resolvable? How do we see our own selves?
Yeah. I mean, you make me think of, you know, there's that classic line, you know, about even good people are capable of terrible things.
Mm.
And vice versa. Mm. I think we live in a world when it comes particularly to sexual abuse that we want to paint people as singularly evil.
Mm.
And it's partly why then when accusations are made against people that we might otherwise admire as public figures, you know, there can be disbelief because we think, well, how can someone who has been so great at football also be this person or whatever it is?
Mm.
And this text really does complicate that in the ways you're describing. I mean, you've framed it theologically, but that you can be remembered well for some things and also have done such heinous things as David has here, which is not just, don't say that lightly, the rape of Bathsheba, but then when he fears because of the pregnancy is going to be caught out, he organizes for her husband to be killed. Mm. So it's also murder.
Which goes to show that he knows that
there's something wrong.
That something's wrong with what he's telling. Like he's acting like, I can do whatever I like. I'm the king. I've got all the power. I'm answerable to nobody. But then, whoops, he knows in his heart.
Yes.
That other people will see it differently.
And he tries to orchestrate a cover-up at first by getting Uriah to come home and sleep with his wife. And Uriah is the honourable man who says, if my soldiers are far away, I won't also.
Yeah.
So there's an even worse sin in taking a life to cover up the previous sin that really makes David, and yet as you say in the later story, when Nathan the prophet confronts him with this kind of parable, David does actually admit, I have sinned, I have offended against the Lord. Interesting. We're in a patriarchal world, so the sin is against the Lord, not Paul Bathsheba.
Yeah.
And the punishment is that child that has come from violence and something wrong will die. Now, Bathsheba will go on and have four other children with David.
And as I think Will Gaffney would underline here too, that yes, that's a punishment for David that this child should die, but that's a pretty bad punishment for Bathsheba who suffers it bodily. But obviously in a patriarchal culture that's
the way it's framed.
Focus. But. Yep.
And I mean part of the – you know, and I do want to do a shout out to both Will Gaffney and Jennifer Brooks, both African American scholars whose commentary on the Working Preacher site on this text is very powerful and you know, brilliant, and who have captured some of the dynamics of abuse here. And that, you know, when Uriah's killed, first he's away and then he's killed, this leaves Bathsheba without the protection of any man in her life. And so she has almost no choice. I mean, whether she was given a choice at all, but she ends up marrying David, her abuser, which is, again, an awful ancient and far too frequent a narrative that she has nowhere else to turn but to the protection of the very man who's put her in this position.
I wonder whether at this point it might be worth just pointing out that Bathsheba's story has a very interesting ending. So in 1 Kings we find she actually becomes, and this is not to diminish what we've just been talking about in terms of what she's subjected to, but she becomes incredibly influential in the royal court and crucial to Solomon's rise. You know, so – and – as you've indicated, she's one of, you know, a very small percentage of Hebrew women named in the narrative and remembered.
Yeah. Well, and women named in the Hebrew narrative, but she's not a Hebrew woman. She's a foreign woman who gets.
But in this narrative, she's named.
Yes. So, and this is where the washing is interesting. And again, I'll put a link to this. I read a quite technical article in the Journal of Study of the Old Testament, but talking about all these various verbs for washing and purifying herself in verse 4. And pointing out that these are not verbs associated with the Levitical requirements for washing after menstruation. Women who menstruate need to isolate and then sacrifice. They don't actually wash in this kind of way. But they are – we see them used with Pharaoh's daughter who looks after Moses. Mm. She was purifying herself and washing when she sees Moses. And for Ruth in the story of Ruth. And these are, again, foreign women who end up rearing Jewish leaders. And so the way that the text, there's this, again, subversive other story of Bathsheba embedded here, that even in the washing after her rape, a way to interpret it could be she's sanctifying herself, she's purifying herself, that puts her in this other lineage. And I think that there we have some editorial decisions probably.
It's very interesting connections though. I'm intrigued and, convinced. I find that compelling.
Yes.
And, you know.
And maybe liberating or empowering in that her story begins as a victim of rape, but she is remembered in the tradition as the mother of King Solomon and the mother of four other children to David. And there is a sense that she finds a way to make a life and to kind of, you know, I think there is something liberating in that, that you were saying before, both David's story and hers are not left at this point.
No.
Yeah. No. Well, shall we move on to...
Let's do it.
Did you know we have a Facebook group? You can find a link at our website, bythewell.com.au.
Well, we move just to John and then maybe refer to Ephesians.
I think that makes sense. John 6, 1 to 21. So this is a feeding story. We recently had, the bits around Mark's feeding story, but John does some different things here. And really we're at the beginning of a bunch of John 6 in the lectionary over the next few weeks. And just to give it some big picture framing, we have the feeding of the 5,000 here, the text today, also with this little bit about walking on water. So it's a bit random. But really over the next few weeks, what John does that the synoptics do not do is then has Jesus unpack the meaning and significance of it. So when we encounter these feeding stories in Mark or Matthew or Luke, we're expected to just kind of figure it out. Or we get a few narrative hints. But John, being John, gives us an entire lengthy chapter of Jesus who'll go on to talk about I'm the bread of life and all of this to really double down on the meaning. So the feeding here is framed as a sign.
And it's Jesus who's taking the loaves and doing the work himself, whereas in Mark it's the disciples
who
hand it out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think that's part of the work here of making Jesus himself the sign that will tie later to the I am the bread type sayings. And also a lot of scholars, I'm a bit hesitant to jump too quickly into it, but a lot of scholars will see Eucharistic elements here, partly because John doesn't have a Last Supper in quite the same way as the synoptics. But we're in the context of a Passover, and so all those resonances are there, and the giving thanks language, of course, in Greek is this Eucharisto. You know, it's where we get Eucharist language from. So multiple layers of
Well, I was struck with a connection I read of, and I feel at my great age, perhaps I should have already made this connection myself. I think it might have been Howard Wallace. That Psalm 23 lies behind that make the people sit down and in the vast green grassland, and the Lord getting us to lie down in green pastures. I think there's quite a lot there. You could just preach. If folks, that's new to you as well, or you haven't preached on it, that's very fertile.
Yes.
Pun intended.
And it's partly ties with this idea here that we also only get in John if they wanted to make him king by force, because in that Psalm 23 and lots of other places in the Old Testament, an ideal king is one that feeds the people and gives them the shepherd king, we've talked about this before, who leads them to abundant, you know, pastures. So, yeah, very much a Psalm 23 resonance there.
Yeah.
Is there a way to tie this, or what would you do with this, Fran?
Well, I'm still working on it because I haven't written all my sermon people for this occasion. But I was struck by Philip, the conversation with Philip here, and how that might resonate with Nathan and David's conversation. That is, David sort of Nathan tricks David with the parable, gets him to think at a certain level, and Jesus here is testing. It says he's testing Philip. Where are we going to buy bread for all these people?
Yes,
he offers a real logistical human level problem. Thinking, will Philip buy into that? And he does. He says, goodness me, it's going to be so many people's earnings for so many months.
No,
it's impossible. We can't do it. There's something about the human frame of limited reasoning and a failure to see God in the conversation or holding the entire event or encounter. God is functional atheism is a useful phrase. Mm-hmm. David Axe is a functional atheist in what he does from his rooftop.
Yes.
And Philip's response to Jesus is functional atheism. And we all live like that. We all tell our stories. I mean, why we go, isn't it? Why we go to church or gather in community for Bible study is to be reminded, because we always forget, that it's not just a story about this existence we have. It's not just a story about that we tell ourselves with all the limits and biases and rationalizations. Well-meaning they may all be, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, I did read a couple of things that what Philip does here is what we do in our communities when there's a problem is with mission in our congregation. We'll have a strategy or have a plan. We do need to be sensible with our stewardship and all of the sort of careful decisions that might lay behind that. But we have to do it knowing the gospel is prior to that and comes after it, that we live in grace, that there is something that God does who is so abundant we can't understand, just to scramble the words in Ephesians.
I was going to say you're taking us into Ephesians, which we'll get to in a moment.
So there's something about the story that Ephesians summarises about our existence in the light of Christ's story that is some answer, I think, Christianly speaking, to what we see in David's.
Yeah, and I mean the other parallel, and you pointed out when we're talking about the David story, is this is a king that takes. So again, if you wanted to do some sort of, you know, linking of the stories, you know, Jesus here, yes, he's a reluctant king because he doesn't want to be the king taken by force, so he kind of disappears at that point. But this is Jesus as shepherd king who feeds.
Mm.
He gives so we've got a king that takes and the terrible outcome of that versus a king who gives and feeds so that people are satisfied. And more than that.
I mean,
there's leftovers, there's abundance.
There's abundance. So there's something even in the language between the epistle and the gospel today about fullness and overflowing.
Mm.
There's a complete fullness in the story of David in terms of material wealth and power and influence, but
it's a different
and there's a greed for the desire for greater fullness, but it's an emptiness as well.
Yes,
behind it. So yeah,
yeah. And again, I mean, this is all about Jesus' identity here, because this what seems to me, at least, a bit strange in John's framing of this. You know, when evening came, and then there's just this casual little Jesus walking on the water.
Mm.
Which you can't ignore. And I think again, it's. These are two little vignettes that are all about Jesus' identity.
I'm going to ask, is it also about our limited vision? That is, you know, Andrew Root's one of many scholars who's written about the late modern world's emptiness of transcendence. Like, what have we done to wonder and the other, godly speaking? You know, and there's something about these two vignettes. There's miracle here. Let's not explain them away.
Yes.
So, yes, it's about his identity, of course. But I think there's something else to be played with as well about how we talk about what we understand and what we know.
Yes. And we like to do that in very scientific kind of grounded terms, but here –
and closed off terms, like we close
here
it
we're
off.
Taken into something that is implausible and impossible in every human term but it's revealing something really profound about
how God works.
Yeah. Yes.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. If we flip across to Ephesians, which, I mean, really the section we have today in chapter 3, verse 14 on, is a prayer. And Ephesians does this. It's quite sort of doxological in that we get theology conveyed kind of in a form of a prayer here. Mm. So you could, of course, use this liturgically and incorporate this language into your own prayers. You could, if you really don't want to deal with John 6 or 2 Samuel 11, you could preach on this, and it's a chance to talk about what we do when we pray. And this is very much a prayer of praise that gives glory to God. Why do we need to give glory to God? Does God need our, you know, exploring the different types of Christian prayer we use liturgically and in other places. But I like what you said before, Fran, that this also just, the language here is so lofty, it takes us beyond, it takes us into this abundant graciousness of God, this language of surpassing, that, you know, we can't comprehend, sorry, I can't speak today, the breadth, length, height, depth of God's power. You know, it takes us, it reminds me of Julia Baird's Phosphorescence book, which talks about the perspective of the overview of effect of astronauts seeing from space, where just all of a sudden there's a different view of the world.
There's also something too in Ephesians, and maybe not, and oh, I should say, folks, we've got an Ephesians scholar visiting next week, Martin Wright, so he'll give us the full lowdown and probably correct anything we might have just said, Robin.
But yeah, that's right. You can then disregard everything we've just said.
So, yeah, listen out for that one next week. But there's something that touched on in here, but all of Ephesians does, is to make sure we see the utter connection between our worship, our discipleship, our theology, and our ethics, and how we live life, and how they're not separable.
Yep.
And that's summarised too here. And there's also something I would want to highlight too, that we've talked about this before, that we can turn the gospel into a different kind of a law by trying to be good enough and to live it all out well enough and be abundant enough. And this Ephesians 3 is a corrective against that.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I mean, so look, there's rich, I feel like there's such richness of things to preach on this week, things that are incredibly timely and also speak against, you know, another divide we have where somehow in church we only consider pious things. And of course, the David and Bathsheba story takes us right into the messiness of human behavior and evil and wickedness in the world. And in some ways, a rare chance for preachers to name carefully but explicitly that sexual abuse and anything that takes away, you know, is never acceptable. And it's why we don't read such texts as somehow normative or sanctioned by God, and we've got to keep reading that story. Before we sign off, I just want to say, folks, I'm off on 6 months sabbatical, going off to try and write a book. But we have a fantastic range of co-hosts who are going to sit in this chair with Fran. So you'll get a great variety of different voices and different scholars and ministers.
So the next 4 or so weeks is Reverend Dr. Kylie Crabb will be joining me, and Reverend Dr. Sean Winter after that, and Reverend Dr. Sally Douglas, and
pretty
Reverend
much just
Carolyn Francis.
A bunch of Reverend doctors.
And Reverend Rachel Kronberger towards the end of the session. So I'll miss you, Robin, but I'm looking forward to conversations with these.
Yeah, it should be great. I'll be listening on the other side of the mic this time.
Thanks for listening, folks.
Bye.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College, the Uniting Church in Australia, and produced by Adrian Jackson.